This is Rebecca Daniel-Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2008 podcast series. Today we are speaking with counselor, professor, and the author of Solution-Focused Counseling in Schools, Dr. John J. Murphy. Dr. Murphy is a professor of counseling and psychology at the University of Central Arkansas. John taught high school before receiving his doctorate in school psychology. He completed postdoctoral training in family therapy, popular workshop presenter, and has trained many helping professionals over the years. Welcome, Dr. John Murphy.
Well, good morning.
Good morning. We're so happy to have you with us today. I finished reading your book last night, Solution-Focused Counseling in Schools, and I really liked this book very much. For the most part, it is a strategy that working school counselors and school psychologists could adopt, and it requires no money, no new resources from the school, and but I would say that it requires somewhat of a paradigm shift, and this shift I see is toward recognizing and working with a student's inner strengths and inner resources. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me stop for a moment and ask you my first question, which is, what is solution-focused counseling?
Well, solution-focused counseling is really a branch of solution-focused therapy, which was a term coined by Steve DeShazer and Insoo Kim Berg from the Milwaukee Brief Family Therapy Center in the early 1980s, when they discovered that it was a lot quicker to ask people what was right and working in their lives as compared to the usual approach, which was to do the initial assessments, basically trying to diagnose problems and size up clients in regard to what was wrong with them and what was not working. And they found not only that clients engaged more in that conversation, which is not surprising, but also that they were able to conclude therapy a lot quicker because essentially they started with something that was already moving in the right direction for clients, and they built solutions from that. And so solution-focused therapy, I think two main components as it originated with DeShazer and Berg's work. One was to encourage clients to envision a better future, that is, what they would like their lives to be like in the future. And the second was a real dogged pursuit of anything that was happening in their lives that was conducive to that future or moving toward that future. And they called these exceptions to the problem. Instead of just figuring out what was bothering them or concerning them, the problem, they tried to find these instances of non-problem, times when the problem was not occurring, and essentially asked clients, what would it take to make that happen more often? And so helping clients formulate goals for the future and locating and building on these exceptions are kind of the two primary aspects of solution-focused therapy as it was originally designed. And certainly those are still very central parts of solution-focused therapy as it's discussed today.
Yeah, and then the other question is, and this is, you have so many fascinating examples in your book, and we'll talk about some of those, but it was very interesting to me when you talked about the DSM piece. I had not known until reading, finishing your book, that there were only 66 DSM diagnoses in 1952, and in 2000 there were 397. And it's growing. Am I correct?
Oh, yeah. I suspect that there will be even more in the next addition, and to be fair, I don't think this is there's any kind of an intentional kind of motive here to make matters worse or bring people down. I just think that there's sort of a momentum here in the profession that's based on, as you said, kind of a paradigm prevailed in our in the helping professions, and that is the more we can figure out what's wrong with someone, the better we'll be able to help them correct that. And that, of course, is helpful to some folks to know and have a name for something, and people do occasionally experience relief from that. But the solution-focused approach, again, moves more toward, okay, where are you right now? Where do you want to be? And what are you doing that could help us build toward that kind of future? Yeah, the DSM, it's an interesting story. I think a lot of people are unaware of that. And, you know, if you're kind of strange like me, you do things like calculate that since the original version in 1952, that's one disorder every 2 months.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And, when you know, when you look at things like that, it's a bit of a concern. And if the diagnostic approach was working the way it was originally designed, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But diagnosis has never lived up to its original promise, which was to help people predict kind of future concerns and to help people select treatments or interventions that would resolve problems. And unfortunately, it has come far short on both of those goals. And therefore, we really have to start questioning whether spending all that time trying to figure out what to call an individual or their problem is really worth the effort, because it just hasn't panned out that way when you really read the research on the reliability and validity of these categories, especially when it comes to children.
Oh, absolutely. And another interesting point was that I hadn't thought about, until I read your book, I hadn't thought about how our emphasis has been on the diagnosis instead of on the strengths of the child or the client. And we're talking about solution-focused counseling vis-a-vis the schools, but this is really something that can be used with anybody. Am I correct?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, the notion of building on strengths and resources is a robust and versatile concept that applies to helping any individual or group or organization make the kind of changes they want to make. So, yeah, these are concepts that are, in my opinion, supported by research indicating that one of the most efficient and effective ways we can bring about change is to build on what clients bring to the process, instead of assuming that we need to give them something that they do not have already.
One of the examples in your book, and there's more than one example of this in your book, but that I thought was fascinating, is working with adolescents or even younger clients who are really oppositional and defiant, and how wonderful your technique worked with those children. Do you want to say a few words about that? Because that is a client, oh my gosh, John, that's a client that is difficult for school counselors, difficult for teachers, difficult for parents, and even difficult for trained family therapists. But boy, I saw it working in the cases you described in your book. Do you want to say a little bit about that client and this technique with that client?
Sure, and I certainly don't want to convey the idea using these kind of techniques will work with everyone, and we've all been around the block enough to know that nothing works exactly as it's intended every mm-hmm. time. But I am going to include in the book examples in which these strategies kind of unfold the way that they are designed.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't just mean the only clients in that book are ones where it worked perfectly, but mm-hmm. with that being said, there are some assumptions of this way of viewing people and problems that inform this kind of work. And one is that everyone is motivated toward something.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. and so the assumption here is that if a young person is perceived as oppositional toward a certain type of goal or change, that it's not necessarily an inherent flaw in the child or the adolescent. It's that maybe we need to work toward finding something they're willing to work for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, as simple as that sounds, is a huge assumption in terms of this way of working. It's a very important one.
Yes.
It's basically giving clients the benefit of the doubt, if you will. But I don't think it's a stretch. If people just think about it in our own lives, we're all faced with certain requests that we may not be too crazy about pursuing for whatever reason, and therefore we don't either work at all toward them or we don't work as hard as we would if it was a goal that we embraced as personally
yes.
meaningful. And I think that's the key with working with young people who might be considered as oppositional or defiant mm-hmm. or uncooperative or apathetic, and the names go on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the idea is let's assume that what we need to do is to persist in our efforts to find the right goal. And, of course, the right goal needs to be their goal. And
mm-hmm.
That's the biggest stumbling block or barrier in counseling is mm-hmm. usually when counseling stalls, it's because we are working towards something that the client does not embrace. And in other words, we're working on a goal that we or someone else thinks is important,
mm-hmm.
but the person sitting in front of us is not too keen on or hasn't embraced at all. And
yes.
that's particularly evident with young people, since the majority of them are referred by someone else. So that has huge implications about how we approach them from the opening
yes.
moments of counseling. We can't certainly can't assume that they're there on their own volition and
mm-hmm.
choice. And so we need. I like to just make that clear to them. I know how you got here. Let's figure out a way that to find something that's important for you to work on in regard to, how your school behavior fits into your bigger values in your life, let's talk about that so that we can make this time that we have meaningful to you. So I think finding that goal
mm-hmm.
That's important to the student in this case, if we're working in schools, is the key to this whole issue of working with so-called resistant or oppositional clients, regardless of their age.
Mm-hmm. I think also part of the paradigm shift, if one were to use these tools, is to be open to your evaluation or your write-up of the client being slightly different than what we are accustomed to. And I'll give you an example. I was working in Hawaii, and I was talking about strength-based assessments with some counselors, and one of the counselors said, "Oh, I have this very difficult teenager, and he will not come up with one single strength, and he hates everyone, he hates himself, on and on. Okay, so I spoke with this client for a while, and I finally did get one thing that he thought he was very good at. And the first sentence in my evaluation, when I was helping her do an evaluation and was doing one to give her an example, the first sentence was, Lily is a very accomplished fisherman.
Yeah.
And okay, we're not accustomed to looking at an evaluation and seeing that on the first line. Am I correct?
Absolutely. And I think that you really hit on an important aspect of just this whole work, because again, this way of looking at things has major implications for assessment.
Mm-hmm.
I view this as a way of thinking, a way of professional being, not techniques that we do to clients to get them to do what we think they should do.
It's yes.
The way of thinking about people, and that's a huge kind of a concept to consider in the face of the way things are usually talked about. But, you know, text, like a report,
mm-hmm.
is just a variation of language, and we know what kind of impact language has on how people think about themselves and their life circumstances. So
mm-hmm.
I think text, whether it's through assessment reports, referral forms, which is oftentimes the first step in
mm-hmm.
the process of initiating services, I think this way of thinking about people and problems has really major implications about how we structure and word intake and referral
mm-hmm.
forms, right on through kind of evaluation reports or intervention reports, whatever we want to call them,
mm-hmm.
It really has some serious implications. I work on it's called a behavior intervention project in the region where I am, and we go out to schools and work with students who are considered most challenging kids in the school district as far as behavior goes and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And we have structured our referral forms to reflect the kinds of things we're talking about here. We have the usual, you know, describe the problem and what happens before and after, because, you know, this approach is not problem phobic and it's not solution forced, it's
mm-hmm.
solution focused. So it certainly, I would never rule out, certain pathways to solution. And one is knowing about the problem and when it happens and all that. But we've added items like, who do you look up to in your life?
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your talents, like you did with this this young person?
Yes.
And find out that, you know, they're an accomplished fisherman.
Mm-hmm.
And gee, I mean, what implications that have? That
mm-hmm.
that means that when they are interested in something, they can get better at it,
mm-hmm.
as they have in this case. And
yes,
all those things have implications for a different view of, you know, the nature, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Of this person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you brought that up, because
mm-hmm.
I work with school districts, and a lot of times one of the first things we do is revise the referral form by including these kinds of strengths and resources in the mix, along with the more traditional problem-related information.
Yes.
Because that gives us just greater flexibility and more pathways to change.
Yes, and this young gentleman, you've seen this, and every counselor who's listening to us has seen this. He, head down, angry, I don't want to be here, the teachers hate me, my parents hate me. It was all negative, it was just going down, okay? And then when I finally hit on the thing that meant something to him, you know, I'll never forget this. He held his head up high. He had a smile on his face. He told me about that he went spearfishing, and he would go underwater, and he would spear a lobster and bring it home that night, and how proud his family was of him when he brought home lobsters for his family to eat. And he just, it transformed him. And I also would, you know, there's no magic cures, and we know that. But I would also posit that it's possible when somebody reads this report about this young man, and it starts with, he is an accomplished fisherman, that it would set the tone for the next person who's going to read this report,
yep.
That it's at least possible that that could happen. Is that, what do you think about that?
Oh, I agree. I mean, you know, we don't know what's going to happen until it happens, but I think
right.
That certainly sets the probability for something like that. And, you know, first impressions last. And
mm-hmm.
I have a kind of a similar approach to these reports. Again, not candy coating the concerns or the problems and the frustrations and so on that accompany that. By any means, not minimizing or candy coating that, but you know, trying to round out the picture, and not only do I think this provides more solution opportunities or avenues, mm-hmm. it also is more useful in engaging the motivation and energy of the people involved. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if someone just hears a litany of what's wrong with them, I mean, this mm-hmm. is like a 12-round boxing match, and you know, by the time you get done with that process, especially thinking that oftentimes the very first step in this whole service process is this pathology-based intake
mm-hmm.
Form, and all these questions that are essentially just, you know, searching for what's wrong and not working for people under every possible rock, that's a rather demoralizing experience for a lot of people who are already demoralized by the time they have the courage maybe to initiate
yes.
help.
Yes.
And, you know, when you think about that from the standpoint of, you know, the clients,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's I don't think it's a stretch to envision what maybe dampens their hope a bit more after this kind of first experience where they might even learn more about what's messed up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I like your miracle question, too.
Yeah, that's not mine.
That's not yours. Where is that from? Let's give kudos to whoever came up with it.
Well, kudos to the originators of mm-hmm. of solution-focused therapy, Steve DeShazer and Sue Kimberg and in Milwaukee. Absolutely. And a lot of those strategies, they just discovered kind of fortuitously, mm-hmm. like many of the great simple ideas in our
mm-hmm.
field are discovered. You know, somebody thought of it and tossed it out. Although that
mm-hmm.
way of inviting people to consider a future has some origins in Milton Erickson's work. He called it
mm-hmm.
pseudo-orientation in time, which is
mm-hmm.
just kind of a psychobabble phrase or I think he often had clients look into imagine they were looking into a crystal ball and you know, seeing themselves
mm-hmm.
a month from now or 6 months from now
mm-hmm.
In a much better spot. Describe to me what's happening. What
yes.
do you see? What's different about you and other people? And basically fleshing out that image or vision. And that's really, I think, a precursor for the solution-focused strategy of the miracle question. And
For those people, let me just stop you for one moment. For those people who haven't read the solution-focused counseling books, could you say what the miracle question is so that they will they'll know what we're talking about?
Sure. The miracle question is basically asking a client if there were a miracle that occurred tonight while you were sleeping
mm-hmm.
and the problem that you came here with that we're focusing on in counseling here just vanished,
mm-hmm.
Then tell me what would be different about the next day. That's essentially the question.
Yes.
And you flesh it out by asking for details and encouraging clients to describe maybe what they're feeling and seeing differently, how they're acting differently,
mm-hmm.
and basically kind of unfold what they envision as
mm-hmm.
a future without the problem.
And you give the client a wonderful gift, because often with all of these pathologies that we talk about and all of the behaviors, and the kid has been, it's been quote-unquote bad, and all of this surrounding the circumstances in which the child comes in to see you or the school counselor, it's very hard for them to get a vision of how things absolutely could be better. And what would it look like if it was better?
Yeah, I do too. And I think, you know, it's basically just encouraging people to look ahead and really spend some time thinking about and mm-hmm. actually, I guess, kind of, you know, living, at least in an imaginary kind of a way, experiencing what that would be like. And that's bound to boost a bit of hope and mm-hmm. possibility. You know, in itself, it doesn't necessarily change actions, but I think it sets the tone to make it much more probable that people will, you know, persist in trying to actually pursue that,
yes.
that future. The other thing I think that's important about that and everything mm-hmm. in this approach, at least as far as, you know, the way I do it, which is important too, because everyone's version of solution-focused work, of course, is slightly different.
Right.
On who they are. But the other thing I like about that and the other kinds of ideas and strategies here is that it continues to place the client center stage.
Yes.
The client is the hero in this drama we call counseling.
The complete person of the client.
Not just the
diagnoses that people are sending them to your office with, but the total picture of the client.
Yeah, and you know, those all the clients have stories just like all of us. They're,
mm-hmm.
all those stories have some grounding in, they have some validity, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do demonstrate certain kinds of problems. The question is not necessarily are these stories true. The question is some stories are more useful than others.
Mm-hmm.
Which stories are we going to attend to in a more, persistent way in counseling? That's
mm-hmm.
the question. It's not whether or not these behaviors have caused serious problems,
mm-hmm.
so on and so forth. Now, the question is, what kind of stories about this individual and views of this person are going to be most helpful in helping to change the situation? So
mm-hmm.
it's a very pragmatic and a very client-directed way of working. And actually, therein lies strength and usefulness.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's one thing the research tells us and screams, it's that outcomes are based on the extent to which clients are involved and participating in this process, you know, the extent
Absolutely.
To which they're engaged.
Yes.
And so as long as we keep them front center
mm-hmm.
and, you know, we continue to check with them as to how the process is working and so on, I think is the extent to which we'll have positive outcomes.
I couldn't agree more. Now let's shift for a minute to talk about this work with school counselors specifically. You obviously see this approach as very relevant to school counselors and others who work with school problems. So what makes it particularly appropriate or effective for use in schools?
Well, for one thing, it's designed for kind of a brief implementation period. I mean this way of working was originally designed at a place called the Brief Family Therapy Center.
Mm-hmm.
Schools, of course, are not anything close to private practice there, or
right.
where you typically have, you know, these Woody Allen like, you know, 20 years of therapy, you know, twice a week. Sometimes we're lucky if we can get a 10-minute conversation in walking down the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these strategies, for example, the finding exceptions to the problem, can be done on the fly. You can be walking with a teacher or a student down the hallway
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
say, you know, your teacher told me that it was a little better in math class this morning. And, you know, I'm wondering what you did to make that happen, because that's pretty cool that it was better.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to just think about that, you know, for the next day or so, what you did to make that happen. And I'm going to call you tomorrow afternoon, and maybe you can teach me what you did, mm-hmm. and we'll take it from there. I mean, that, you know, that's something you can do. Implement a lot of these strategies kind of on the fly. Mm-hmm. You know, I work with school psychologists as well as counselors and social workers and any kind of like helping people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, school psychologists, for example, do a lot of testing. You know,
right.
they complain about that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're doing so much testing, they don't often have time to do intervention and things.
Mm-hmm.
And counselors are inundated with
mm-hmm.
a lot of tasks that you know, they take them maybe away from this kind of counseling with kids.
Mm-hmm.
And what I tell people is you know, don't wait for the magical day that, you know, the school administrator or department administrator comes up to you and says, you know, I've been thinking about this, and I think you really need more time to do this kind of stuff that you really want to do more of. And
mm-hmm.
don't wait for that day. You know, seize mm-hmm. the opportunities. And, you know, for school psychologists, I said, you can ask a question like that between two subtests on the Wechsler scale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Really can. And you
can
go back to it when the student leaves and says, now, you know, and say, mm-hmm. now think about this. So even if you feel rather, I guess, restricted and stuck, as real as those constraints are,
mm-hmm.
Don't give up on the possibility of doing some change-focused work.
Mm-hmm.
Within some of these other duties that seem maybe not as much focused on counseling.
Yeah, you know, I receive calls from school counselors on a fairly regular basis with the following complaint, which I know you're very accustomed to hearing this too, and that is, I'm always doing paperwork. I'm never getting face-to-face time with the kids. You know, that's a common complaint. Okay, one of the wonderful things about putting these techniques into your toolbox is you absolutely can, in a few minutes, make an intervention. You can say, as you're walking with the kid down the hall, you can say, I hear you got a C in that class, you know? I mean, I hear you got a C on your test. You know, you used to get D's and F's, and now you got a C? That's great. How'd you do it? What was different? What happened? That's a quick, easy kind of solution-focused counseling intervention that can, you know, even for the counselors doing a lot of paperwork, make them feel like they're also doing important work with the students.
Oh, I agree. And, I think getting back to that question about, you know, why school people find this appealing is,
yes.
I think the focus on strengths but we got into this business to lift people up,
yes,
to encourage them, and teachers did too. Interestingly, for every 4 or 5 trainings I do with counselors and sort of mental health professionals, I do maybe one with teachers, because they want to be this way with their students. They got into the business the same reason we did. You know, they want to encourage people. They want to find ways of working that not only help people but keep themselves energized and hopeful. You know, I found that working this way, certainly personally, has kept me in a position where I can sit in front of anybody, culturally responsive. I mean,
mm-hmm.
So just by nature of being client-driven,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're not coming in and saying and assuming that this sort of counseling style is my style and
mm-hmm.
that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's no. It's this client needs to teach me what style and approach is going to work better for them. I may have noticed that there's even a short form.
Mm-hmm.
That I use, you know, the session rating scale
that
the meeting that says, was there anything missing? How did my approach work?
Mm-hmm.
Did we talk about what was important for you? Did you feel respected and understood?
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of, again, that sort of client-driven mindset, I think, is a way to keep us in check with regard to cultural preferences. And so that's another.
I thought that was wonderful. In the appendix of your book, there is the Child Outcome Rating Scale and the Young Child Outcome Rating Scale, among other tools in the back. And I thought this was a way of also making the client feel that you saw their strengths, that you believed that they had strengths. You, in fact, were going to ask them to comment on how you were doing with them.
Absolutely, because, the research, again, is just compelling. The client's assessment, their subjective perceptions of progress and the alliance or the relationship with the counselor are huge predictors of ultimate outcomes, meaning that their kind of first impressions and initial kind of bonding with the counselor and their view of whether this whole thing is working is vital to know early.
Absolutely.
If it goes beyond a couple sessions, the literature is very clear about this. If you go through two or three sessions and it's not clicking with the client, then the chance of a positive outcome are very slim, if at all. And so, again, this is a positioning, a way of positioning ourselves, different paradigm that says that kind of shifts, I guess, the locus of direction here in the way we work with people. It says you are in the driver's seat, and what I need to do is learn what I can do to be most useful to you. Therefore, I'm going to have to ask you questions, and you're going to have to teach me, what works for you and what you want out of this whole thing.
Another thing that I thought of when I was reading your book is many people have accomplished a lot when you talk to them about how they accomplished what they did and who was important in their life and helping to encourage them. I'm a big biography reader, so you will see this kind of thing. They will often say there was a teacher. There was a teacher when I, and it doesn't matter if it was in the 1800s, it doesn't matter when you're talking about this. There was a teacher who was wonderful. And what was wonderful about this teacher? This teacher believed in me. This teacher, no one else did. No one thought I'd become anything. And then there was this teacher, you know. And I thought to myself, this solution-focused counseling, which I think is fantastic, I thought to myself, you know what? There were some teachers long ago who just had that natural gift. They knew how to do that.
Absolutely.
Long ago, they knew how to even take a child who could not see the positive aspects of themselves and help them see that.
Well, hey, in the dedication of my book, I thanked my mother, Mary Murphy, because she was solution-focused before there was a name for it.
Before there was solution-focused.
That old, she was solution-focused before solution-focused was cool.
Was cool. Yeah, I love that. But the beauty of your book is that, say you don't come by that naturally, like most of us don't. Most of us aren't that.
We're socialized into sort of that problem mode as well.
Yes, and particularly when we go through, get our master's in counseling, our doctorate, where we end up getting, many of our classes are focused on that. They're focused on the diagnostic criteria of finding a pathology, and very rarely do you receive any lectures about finding the client's strengths and finding the client's solutions within themselves. We're going to have to kind of wind this down, but I do have a last couple of questions I want to ask you.
I said I was Irish when I...
Oh, gosh, yes.
You didn't know what you were getting into, did you?
Yes, I didn't know. And, you know, I'll tell you the truth. My last name's Burke, and I've been married to an Irishman for 27 years, so I get it.
Okay.
Okay. So, you know, I know this is a big question, but I want to ask it anyway because you're a person who has really dedicated your professional life to among other things, the school system, school counselors, school psychologists. What are the future challenges that you see facing school psychologists, school counselors who might want to use these kind of techniques? And what kind of thing in the future do you see either available to them or obstacles to them as they try to do this kind of work?
Oh, wow.
I know. I told you it was a big question, but you're Irish, so go for it.
Well, that just means I can talk a lot. What I say is significant, but for starters, I think that kind of focus needs to dominate every single decision we make, from how we open the school year, what kind of classes students are put in, how they're taught, how they're, you know, referred more specifically in the counseling area, what kind of services we have, how we prioritize these services. And, for example, a school has to be run in an organized way, and there has to be procedures and so on. But when we consider, for example, whether or not to make an intercom announcement,
mm-hmm.
that goes throughout the entire school,
mm-hmm.
and every single classroom is interrupted with this announcement, do we consider that if this is all about learning and growth and advocating for the students, is there possibly maybe another way we could do that that would convey our priority on the students are what we're here for?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then what kind of impact that has on the percentage of administrative work a school counselor might be asked to do,
mm-hmm.
as compared to meeting with students or groups of students and trying to help them learn to study better or change certain behaviors or so on and so forth. I think in schools is the same as the future anywhere, in any
mm-hmm.
institution. It has to start with an absolute soul commitment
mm-hmm.
to what the purpose of the whole thing is in the first place, and continual mm-hmm. reminders of that as we go through and set up logistics of how we go about our everyday work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that affects not only what happens within counseling sessions, but it affects the larger picture of carving out time for activities that contribute to the mission of helping students grow and learn and succeed and so on. And I know that's a rather broad response, but
mm-hmm.
it all
mm-hmm.
starts with what the purpose is. And in counseling, the purpose is to help people change,
mm-hmm.
not to figure out what to call them in order to help them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to check off that, you know, we saw students, you know, three or four times and so on, or it's purely about helping them change. And that's what, you know, I've been about for, you know, the last 20-some years is let's figure out what we know about change.
Yes.
And try to translate that into user-friendly, practical strategies that people in schools can use.
Well, would you mind leaving us with a story of a time when you used solution-focused counseling in a school, and it was particularly helpful?
Sure. It's just...
I know there's many.
so many,
and
my gosh, what a privilege to be in this business.
Yes.
You know, because it's certainly a two-way street. These
mm-hmm.
students just energize me and inspire me
mm-hmm.
constantly.
Mm-hmm.
I'll really pick a student that I've written about. He was a third grader, and actually this is it was a really kind of a dramatic experience for me because mm-hmm. it really got me into this way of working. But quite by accident, it was a student that had experienced a whole lot of family challenges, was removed from his parents' custody due to abuse. This is a third grade student. And an extremely challenging life history. He's 9 years old, and he was referred for kind of academic problems. And this was actually an assessment situation, and I was just talking with him about, brothers and sisters and, mm-hmm. and things that we were required to fill out this form about child development and social history. And I was going through there and came upon some of these just hugely traumatic and challenging circumstances in his life. And he stopped talking, and I stopped talking, and I didn't know what else to say. It was just really grabbed me, this great-looking little 9-year-old who's now, sort of sobbing across from me. And this is probably my second year of practice. This is mm-hmm. 25 years ago, probably. And the only thing I could think of to say to him at that point was something that just shifted the whole conversation. And it was, how do you manage to hang in there instead of giving up? Mm-hmm. And as you described before, sometimes when you talk to students about actually what they're doing to make things better or even to keep things from getting worse, they shift into a sort of a different mode. And I'm condensing this. Mm-hmm. He looked at me and said, my aunt always tells me that quitters never make it. And I said, well, wow, what else does she say that helps you? And one thing led to another, and we had a conversation for 10 or 15 minutes about pieces of him and his life that were functional and that were helping him to cope as well as he had with all these difficulties. Mm-hmm. And the entire conversation shifted, the energy level shifted.
Yes.
And he provided probably 4 or 5 specific intervention ideas mm-hmm. used to, one was like a tutoring program because his older brother helped him, and another is to say these affirmations that his aunt used to kind of pump him up and so on. And I just was blown away by that.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking, what just happened? And I wonder if there's a way that instead of by stumbling into it, mm-hmm. I could actually learn to do this in a more planned and structured way. That's what led me to start pursuing what's out there that kind of fits with this way of working with people. And,
mm-hmm.
That was, 25 some odd years ago.
Wow.
And it's evolved from then. But that experience really has never left me, and it continues to encourage me, even in the most difficult of circumstances, to have faith in people and their resources.
I think of, also both of us being in this business for a long time, I think of how much clients have taught me.
Oh, well, it's...
It's just amazing. I mean, they have taught me this technique isn't so good, and this one is really good,
Really, and the thing is for me, the next client will walk in, and it'll be just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the constant in that is that the client is in the role of the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I heard someone say something that I think was just tremendous. They said, the best practitioners are shaped into effectiveness by their clients.
It's so true.
Oh my goodness! And I mean, if we allow ourselves, they can teach us so much,
Absolutely. Time is coming to an end here, but I want to thank you very much, Dr. John J. Murphy, for joining me today and discussing your excellent book, Solution Focused Counseling in the Schools. Second edition. I strongly suggest school counselors, school psychologists, teachers, and maybe even parents go out and buy this. It's practical. It's readable. I think it's just a fantastic book.
Well, thanks so much, Rebecca. Okay. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. Please go to the American Counseling Association's website at www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page for all associated links and to write to the author and the host of this podcast. And I'm always interested in your future ideas for podcasts. This is Rebecca Daniel-Burke, your host for the ACA 2008 podcast series, signing off.